When it comes to what we wear, the streets of metropolitan Australia seem to be changing. This generation of young people are using what's called gender-neutral fashion to express themselves. But I'm wondering, have we seen this kind of approach before? What are now called non-normative and non-binary approaches to dress used to be labelled in the olden days as unisex clothing. I'm thinking here about things like apricot tunics and his and hers caftans in the 1960s. Oh, bless. Peter McNeil is a distinguished professor of design history at the University of Technology, Sydney. Peter, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Am I right in thinking of those times as being a sort of first foray into what we called unisex clothing back in those days?
Yes, the 60s was a really important precursor of the little fashion revolution that seems to be happening now. And unisex clothes in the 60s were really very much about an assertion that people were equal, that the genders were equal.
So it was a political statement, particularly for the women's movement then, back in those days.
It was very important when it emerges around 66 with Finns, with Swedes, with American designers. It's a kind of a bit of a pan-global movement, and it's definitely connected with feminism. It's got links to black power and also a little bit of nascent gay power as well. So all the kind of social revolutions that many of your listeners would be familiar with.
But in contemporary Australia, Peter, would I be right in saying that this kind of a gender-neutral approach to clothing is a bit more inclusive than simply saying it's men and women together, because so many different people identify in very many different ways, at least in a contemporary society?
Yes, that's exactly right. We've got to sort of think about what we're talking about with these labels. Unisex clothes had carried the idea that men and women could wear identical garments and look much the same. So in a way, gender was effaced or removed.
It's kind of like a homogenisation, isn't it? That's almost homogenisation.
Yes, it was a sort of utopic idea that men and women could just simply go to a portable wardrobe of elements and almost wear each other's clothes. It's actually connected to older revolutionary movements. You can see it around the time of the Russian Revolution with the constructivists who were interested in kind of unisex workers' clothes, like overalls and things like that.
Right, well, and I was thinking too about the same trends in clothing in, say, communist China after Mao Zedong took over power.
Yes, and there you could think a little bit about how anti-fashion is a really interesting concept to think about. Some of those 60s experiments were actually anti-fashion experiments going against the general system. And earlier dress reform, say in the 1880s and 1890s for women, also was about coming up with alternative, more practical, useful modes of dress that, for example, didn't corset or constrict women. And then the weird thing is you've got an artist like Klimt, the much-loved Klimt, running around in a caftan looking really extraordinary.
Yes. And then that was, of course, mimicked by other people, maybe to lesser effect. when it comes to today now, Peter, I take it, though, that the kind of clothing choices that are available, not only in this country, but in places like Europe, North America, mean that you don't have to feel like you're part of a same mass movement. There's still room for individuation within those clothing choices, but you just have a greater range of what's available without it being a gendered division.
Yes, and imagine if we can go into department stores, you can in many European cities, and not look around in vain for the sign saying men, women, but actually try on anything you like. We've got to remember that Mick Jagger wore a Mr. Fish miniskirt in 1969 for a big concert in Hyde Park, so these ideas have been percolating around in the social consciousness for a long time. But I think the really interesting thing going on now is the kind of rise of the concept of non-binary, which is a very different word from androgynous or unisex.
Yeah, that's right. So how does non-binary work when it comes to clothing?
Well, for example, I was having a nice Sri Lankan dinner last night and I looked in a shopping centre across the way, and there was a non-binary butcher. And I thought, wow, this country is really coming a long way. Well, this young butcher was of indeterminate gender to me, was dressed in an unconventional manner, and I was there for closing time and saw the butcher take off their uniform, and the person whose gender doesn't really matter, but I think it was a guy, left inner spaghetti string top, midriff showing with a lovely earring and a little bit of maquillage dotted around. And, you know, once again, I thought, you know, there is actually a younger generation are so great, and we've got to look to them because they always know where the ideas are in society. People like you and me, we actually don't know. We're way behind. And
I must say, Peter, when you first mentioned that, I thought you meant, I don't know why I thought this, you were talking about the actual products in the store being non-binary as meat. So now I understand.
No, okay. The butcher, you know, there's such a stereotype of the way the trade should appear in a country like Australia. And
yeah,
I thought
sure.
That was a really, really fascinating example of what's going on generally in the population.
I do remember back in the day when I was doing a food show on Radio National, having a wonderful conversation in store with a vegetarian butcher who was living and working in Sydney and, you know, doing a roaring trade. And so, you know, I guess in some ways what we're talking about here when it comes to clothing and fashion choices is that we are pushing back the boundaries of convention as they should, because that's what every generation, when it comes to clothing, fashion and, you know, attire, does do if they're introducing change.
Yes, and whereas in the 60s the change was very much about women's rights, although there were very important gay designers like the Swede Sigsten, who was a bit like the Halston of Europe and did very well in the US, what we're seeing right now is in a way, the washover of big social movements like the same-sex marriage matter being resolved now with a you know, really surprising and big success for that referendum. And with as many people know, if you talk to younger people about some of these old divisions and binaries that everyone fixated on and they thought the sky was going to fall in, they don't even know what they are. They can also, for the first time, unlike us, see everything on Instagram. You know, I think the social media landscape has really transformed the horizon of possibilities for people with their appearances.
Do you think, therefore, with the kind of the spread and popularity, enormous popularity of social media platforms like Instagram, that some of the barriers to that kind of thinking have eroded beyond the inner city? Do you see this kind of non-binary approach to fashion ever leaving, you know, the main CBDs of our capitals?
I think it's going to be a bit of a slog, but there are signs that it's happening, and it will be. The great thing about fashion is, you see, it's a very interesting phenomenon because it actually enables and helps propel social change. It can be argued that it helps people get ready for social change. And just like there were prohibitions against tattoos in the past that were considered to be criminal, etc., everybody knows that it's a form of fashionable expression now. People delight in their tattoos. I think we are going to see a shift, partly through this interesting mechanism of fashion and taste, and it's connected also to music and style generally. So I'm fairly hopeful that we'll see, you know, we are seeing that in everything from food culture to lifestyle, a breaking down of kind of metropolitan rural binaries in this country.
And when it comes to any kind of new movement in popular culture, it might have its most extreme hub at the centre of highly populated younger areas of our communities, but some of the residue of that change permeates out through the population over time. It's proven to happen, right?
Yes, it does. And another very straightforward way to think about unisex clothing is the sneaker revolution, the T-shirt revolution,
sure.
The uniform adopted by both men and women and non-binary people for decades as college students. They had to retreat from that uniform a little bit when they went into workplaces. But workplaces seem to be changing as well, with a little bit of a shift away from conventional business attire. And maybe that's going to be sped up with what we went through last year, where people actually had to come up with comfortable, acceptable, practical ways of dressing that worked for them in that strange COVID year that we went through.
While we're talking here, Peter, about the possibilities of non-binary fashion, fashion that isn't defined by gender, by sexuality, by preferences like that, let's come back to the commercial aspect of clothing. And surely one of the reasons why there's still men and women sections in so many of our major clothing outlets is because when you double up and divide, you make more money.
Yes, but there's an interesting counter move to that. Bonds, for example, recently announced that they would do gender-neutral, non-binary underwear. And that is their argument, along with many other multinationals, is that they don't want to disenfranchise anybody at all by just running the centuries-old male-female department store clothing system, and that they'll actually...
You mean like Y-fronts versus panties?
Well, of course, lots of men's underwear for a long time now has...
I know.
Moved away from the wife front of
I know. Yes. I know. I was being extreme to make a point. Yeah.
In fact, it's quite retro now to have some wife fronts, you know.
Oh, really? It's come back in.
Yeah. It's retro dressing.
Good to know.
I remember when colored underwear came in when I was a boy. It was terribly exciting to see a pair of hot pink underwear.
Right.
Boys didn't wear colored underwear. This was really like Carnaby Street hitting the main street of Australia. It was a big deal.
So you were saying that Bonds have moved away from those divisions and are now putting out an underwear range that appeals to any kind of preference when it comes to gender identity.
That's right. Any customer, any consumer, and other big brands like H&M have been doing this for some time. The big European department stores have moved away from male-female halls. And it's just an interesting experience of kind of multiplicity and free-floating choice that then's offered to people. Of course, this is not to suggest that everybody's going to suddenly start doing wardrobe switch-outs, but it seems to, you know, I think it's important because it offers particularly young people kind of options when we all know clothing is so important to the way you craft your appearance as a young teen. And if we consider the terrible rate of self-harm and suicide in this country, for example, 25% of 12 to 14-year-olds who die in this country are LGBTI, pretty dreadful yes. figures. I think anything that affirms, you know, difference, sense of self, is actually really, really important socially. And clothing has a role to play there, along with everything, along with all the other support structures and decency and kind of focus on equality.
Peter, along with the inclusivity that goes with those very trends we're talking about here, do you think that that range of demand also means that consumers can imprint upon manufacturers, some of the big ones like Bonds, etc., that they not only require that choice, but also they want that clothing to be made ethically?
Yeah, that's a huge concern now. And it's gone way beyond greenwashing to actually really think about the whole life cycle of clothing. I think the average person in a developed country has 300 pieces of clothing in their wardrobe and throws out about 15 to 20 kilos a year of unworn clothes. So the obscenity of this kind of waste, which is just obscene on any level in terms of common sense, is really now being addressed by people. And there is a bit of a shift away from the fast fashion idea. Of course, the problem is if it's cheaper to buy a T-shirt than get it washed in a hotel, that also tells you something about the very cheap wages being paid to people in developing countries to make this stuff for us.
Yeah, yeah. So you have to really make a stand with your wallet that shows that you are ethically up to the task.
Yes, what we need is there's nothing worse than mindless consumption. Consumption can be a really, really exciting tool to help craft your identity, your relationships, your sense of self, your way of being in the world. And we need our consumer, we need, you know, better awareness, whether it's about, you know, a lot of people don't even know that wool comes from a sheep anymore. We've sort of severed our connection from materiality a lot.
Yeah.
But the great thing is, and it was clear during COVID that people like to make bread, they like to grow houseplants, and they're actually getting much more interested in the clothes they put on every day. So I think we've become a little bit more thoughtful and aware, and of course we have to be with the ecological crisis.
It's a signpost for hope. And Peter, it's been a great conversation. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, great pleasure. I hope you're wearing a really groovy outfit today.
Oh, Peter, I wish I was, but I'm sadly not. But I'll do my best in the future, I promise. Peter McNeil, Distinguished Professor of Design History, the University of Technology, Sydney, talking about the rise of non-gender binary kinds of clothing, whether it's something you can see on a person or not.